Hi, and welcome to the Kubernetes podcast from Google. I'm Craig Box with my very special guest host, Vic Iglesias. Welcome back, Vic. How are you doing?
Doing really well.
It's been a long time since we've had you on the show. It was July 2018, episode number 11. Can't go too much further back than that.
Seems like things have changed a bit in our world.
It's hard to tell. It all just feels the same to me. You're in Santa Barbara. I have to ask you, have you seen any members of the British royal family around?
You know, right now, given how things are going, I've kind of tried to avoid those celebrities in particular. But we have had some nice weather, so I've had occasion to get out and about. But no interactions yet, I'll say.
Do you often see people out hunting for famous people?
I would say yes. What I've been doing more in the hunting space is looking for Pokemon via the Pokemon Go app, which has been a good activity to get ourselves outside. And then, you know, when we're inside, which we've been doing a lot this year, as you can imagine, we're playing the Pokemon card game, which also gives us that experience, which has been nice.
Have the people who make Pokemon Go made any affordances for social distancing?
Yes, absolutely. You used to have to walk around and go to places a lot more, which obviously now you don't want to encourage. So you've had the ability to do remote battles and things like that and battle people that are not exactly next to you or within your area. So that's been nice to have a little bit more ability to engage with it while we're a bit sedentary.
I know it's always sunny in California, but why so warm at this time of year?
Well, you see, I'm in Santa Barbara, California. We have a band of temperatures basically between 68 and 72 degrees all the time. Mm-hmm. So really being outdoors is kind of the obvious thing to do every day. But in our pandemic times, it's been a little harder to find that time to go out into the wilderness where we should be, kind of distancing from folks. So we've been doing a lot more in our homes, which maybe for my kids, it's been Pokemon Go. But for myself, I've been doing a little bit more video gaming. Mm-hmm. Been on Google Stadia quite a bit earlier in the pandemic. Recently got an Xbox and really just enjoying playing soccer and not getting tired by being in a virtual world.
Good. Well, I think that's a good summary of everything that's happened since July 2018. So let's get to the news. GitOps Project Flux has been promoted from the CNCF sandbox to the incubation phase this week. Flux has 14 maintainers from 5 organizations with over 1,800 contributors to the project. It's currently undergoing a rewrite to use the Kubernetes extensibility APIs, with a V2 due out in the coming months. The CNCF now has 20 projects in incubation, with 15 having graduated.
NetApp has expanded their storage platform into Kubernetes with Astra, a fully managed application-aware data management service. Astra supports data protection via snapshots, disaster recovery with remote backups, and portability and migration with active clones. The service is GA on GCP, with other clouds and on-prem to follow soon.
Fairwinds has released Sapphire with 2 Fs, an open source project to solve a very particular problem that you suspect must have bit them very hard once upon a time. Sapphire is aware of container registries that host the same content, and if an image can't be pulled from a registry, it will patch the Kubernetes object to suggest a different one. This allows you to use multiple registries without having to run a local pull-through cache.
You should, of course, make sure all the images in your registries are signed. And Dan Lorenz, container security guy and guest of episode 39, wants to help you. He's built a very simple tool called CoSign, which lets you store signatures next to the containers in a registry, with the signing performed as a step in your CI process. While somewhat of a proof of concept, the tool forms part of a larger Linux Foundation project to improve the security of your software supply chain.
Commodore, with a K, is a new platform for troubleshooting applications running on Kubernetes. It's built to show how deploys or other changes affect an overall system, showing changes and alerts on a timeline, which helps you identify what may have triggered an alert. The platform has entered open beta this week, although gated behind a form, and they are sending out swag to people providing product feedback.
Oracle has announced fully private Kubernetes clusters in Oracle Cloud Infrastructure Container Engine for Kubernetes, a service with 2 acronyms and 4 too many words. Nodes and load balancers could already be part of your private cloud network, and in this release, which is generally available this week, it adds the ability for the Kubernetes API endpoint to be on the private network as well.
Linkerd, the service mesh that really wants you to know that its diet is totally paying off, has launched version 2.10. Many control plane components have moved to extensions, meaning you can run in as little as 200 megabytes, in case you're dialing in from a time before the JVM and you think that's a lot of memory. Other enhancements include support for TCP and multi-cluster services, and marking ports as exempt from protocol detection.
And now, the Kubernetes podcast is proud to present the Money Section, with soundtrack contributed by our guest from episode 127, David Pate.
Talking of diets, the slimmed-down Docker, focusing entirely on developer teams, has taken $23 million in Series B funding. Pay no attention to the fact that they were up to Series E before moving their enterprise business to Mirantis in 2019. Docker stated their annual recurring revenue has grown 170% year on year. The round was led by Tribe Capital.
Cloud-native security vendor Aqua has raised $135 million in a Series E round at a $1 billion valuation, led by Ion Crossover Partners. Aqua values their open source credentials, saying that adoption has more than doubled in 2020, with Trivi, their vulnerability scanner, selected as the default scanner for Harbor Registry, GitLab, and the CNCF's own Artifact Hub.
2 weeks ago, we talked to Camille Potrick from SNCC, and in what must of course be a complete coincidence, SNCC raised a whopping $300 million in their Series E round, valuing the company at $4.7 billion. Led by Accel and Tiger Global, and with 13 other funds participating, SNCC says that more than 27 million developers use their tools worldwide.
Tetrate, the networking company co-founded by Istio's first PM, Varun Talwar, has raised a $40 million Series B round. They will use the money to improve their service bridge platform and hire go-to-market teams worldwide. Tetrate's round was led by Sapphire Ventures.
Finally, last week we spoke to Daniel Mangum from the Crossplane team, who explained his love of compilers and the lower levels of computing. If that wasn't proof enough, he wrote a blog post comparing Crossplane to the LLVM compiler suite and how it relates to the Kubernetes cluster API. Check it out if you like visual aids with your podcasts.
And that's the news.
Gianluca Arbizzano is a principal engineer at Equinix Metal. He is a maintainer on the Tinkerbell project, a CNCF ambassador, and a Docker captain. Welcome to the show, Gianluca.
Thank you for having me.
You got into tech through that venerable web technology, PHP. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I presume that's how a lot of people started. So a lot of my friends and people around me were looking for a website, and I was spending a good amount of time watching a desktop, so I thought maybe I can do something about that. So I just started with PHP. I did some WordPress website, and from there it was a lot of fun. So I keep digging into the topic, and I was studying computer programming at high school, so I was already in the mood of becoming a developer. That's how I got started. At some point I thought, maybe it's time to learn a language that is a compiled one, because I was looking for new challenges. I picked up Go because back then it was popular one. Docker was just raising. HashiCorp was using Go. So I thought, maybe I want to use those tools, so why not?
PHP gets given a bit of a bad time, but it was, like you say, the way a lot of people got into technology. Do you think that as a modern programming language, there's still room for it?
I think so. I also have to say that I didn't really look much at web development since I stopped to develop in PHP. So I know there are way more languages like Elixir that is very popular. And obviously, all the JavaScript frameworks and libraries that you can install in your laptop can do the same. So it's probably biased by me not having much experience on that field for something that is not PHP. But I think so. And also the language changed so drastically because I know they had the types and strict checks on types. It's a different language compared with the one I used, so I can really tell.
The getting started experience was very simple though. You just upload a file, you'd have HTML and PHP code all in the same file, you drop it on a web server and you were live. I think there's some of that's lost with the whole art of compiling and having to deal with runtimes and things. Do you think there's an easy way for younger people perhaps to get started with programming?
I think it's still a good way to start. And as you pointed out, if you want to resolve a website or a file on the internet, you upload it and you're good to go. You don't need to think too much about all the correlation and the worst case scenarios or all the troubles that you are putting yourself into. That is usually something you don't have to think when you start. So it's good that you can have something simple to pick up and just run and see the benefit of actually controlling a CPU in a way or another.
In your career, you've gone between software engineering, programming, and SRE or DevOps. How did you move between those two things? And do you think that they are fluid and you should be able to move backwards and forwards between them as you please?
I think it really depends on where do you want to go, obviously, as a lot of other stuff. You are the one driving the boat, at least for me. I'm lucky to be able to do it. or to feel that I can do it. As I said, I was all the changes I made in my career were driven by the curiosity or the need for a different challenge. Mm-hmm. So when I saw that website and PHP weren't giving me what I was looking for anymore, because I was looking for a new way of developing, I decided to move to Go. And moving to Go, I ended up mastering a lot of the tools that today are DevOps tools. I think the day I decided to switch from a developer to a more DevOps-oriented career was when I understood the power I had as a developer in the infrastructure. So when the cloud provider started to raise in popularity, I saw that I were able to manage and spin up servers quickly with a bunch of APIs. And at that time, a lot of people were in the mindset of, I'm a system administrator and I need to learn how to develop, but I was already kind of a developer somehow. So I just decided to have fun with servers. And it ended up being a good challenge. I joined a company in Turin that still today helps other companies to move to the cloud. So for me, it was a good challenge because I had the opportunity to see a lot of use cases and to actually see the benefit of cloud computing very early in my career. As I said, I'm born and raised in the cloud.
Turin probably is quite a high altitude as well, so a good place to be.
Yeah, that's true. I'm closer to the cloud.
It was great how your example is driving a boat rather than driving a car. A lot of nice lakes around where you live.
Definitely.
Now, another thing about Italians and cloud, you worked at InfluxDB for 3 years. We spoke with Leonardo Di Donato in episode 91. Did you work with him?
I also shared the flat with him for 2 years. So
wow. It's a small world there. It's like every Italian and cloud native had done a stint at InfluxDB at some point.
When I joined, I was one of the early employers in Europe. So I was feeling a bit lonely at some point. So I decided to propose to Leonardo and Lorenzo to join me because I trust them as a developer. We are good friends. So for me, it was a great opportunity to feel less lonely as well.
What were you working on there?
I got hired as a SRE. They have a SaaS offer. And back then they were looking to make a bit of order in there. As you can imagine, InfluxDB had a very high growth and the SaaS offer growth with that, not under a good control. So I was doing automation. Back then, the orchestrator was custom developed in Go. So no Kubernetes, no many DevOps tools. The manager who started the SaaS was coming from CoreOS. So it brings a lot of the approaches that the company had, a good amount of code that were doing something like Kubernetes does for containers, but for AC2.
Did you end up with Kubernetes there?
We moved almost when I left to Kubernetes. So now the version 2 of Influx Cloud runs on Kubernetes.
InfluxDB is a time series database. Do you see a lot of the use cases for it in monitoring and observability?
It's definitely a thing. So we learn quickly how to organize and store logs and events, but the way we use them in an effective way, I think it's still an open question. So InfluxDB definitely helped to make order on the time series, and it is now trying to make a good use of those metrics. We generate so many metrics compared with what we used to with microservices and distributed systems that they are a key value now.
Is it implicitly easy to monitor time series data of a service that's running a time series database?
It depends on how it is written, almost like the application. So I don't think there are many differences. It's mainly that you have a chicken and egg problem. So you have to trust your system. I think what was really complicated at InfluxDB was the fact that we were using InfluxDB to monitor ourselves. So all the bottlenecks that we saw in the product were on us as a user as well. So a lot of the limitation and the workaround that we encountered were super important because we were able to see them and fix them for the customer. But it was also a pain for us as a user because you need to run thousands of AC2 at scale and you have that limitation and that bit that doesn't work. So it's a good challenge. It's a mindset that you develop. So be the guinea pig of yourself is a challenge. But I think it's a good one.
What do you think that experience at InfluxDB did to your feelings about cloud as a career?
I think when you have the opportunity to look at the AWS bill for a SaaS like Influx Cloud, you start to see an opportunity or at least a misunderstanding on the dream of cloud computing.
I should point out other clouds are available.
Yeah, no, that's true. I don't have experience at the same scale as I did for in AWS, but there are different ways to think about hybrid cloud or multi-cloud than the obvious one that we see around.
when you start running something at that kind of scale, and where the bill is a substantial part of your company's outgoings, perhaps, there have been a lot of high-profile people who have said, hey, I should be running these computers myself. Someone else is making overheads here. This is something I can do. Dropbox is a good example. They decided to move away from cloud and start running their own data centers. Do you think that there is a tipping point where that becomes true? And if so, where is that tipping point?
The answer is always in the middle. There are workloads or responsibilities that it's better to outsource, and others that it's better to manage by your own. Equinix Metal, that is the company that I work for today, invests a lot of money on custom hardware and specialized hardware. You can gain a lot of flexibility and a huge performance if you go deep on the stack. And this is something that if you get locked in a cloud provider, you probably can't think about. So the secret here, I presume, it's not really a secret, but the good practice here is to be as flexible and open-minded as possible. There are situations where cloud provider is needed because you need velocity and you don't care about the infrastructure because you have more important things to care about, or somebody else is taking care of the actual spending. So what's the point? When you onboard full responsibility, you need to avoid lock-in in any case, whatever it means.
Let's step the clock back a little bit. Equinix Metal, when you joined, was known as Packet. I know my experience of it was when people wanted to run VMware workloads and things that didn't necessarily run in a hypervised, hyperscale cloud environment. What was Packet good at, and why did you decide to join them?
Their commitment to open source and their community mindset definitely catched my attention, because it is the same mindset that I have personally. So that's definitely something important. I was also thrilled to write code for cloud computing. Mm-hmm. This is something that I think is a good step for me in my career, because as we told before, I worked as a developer, I moved to as a more ops person, and I moved to SRE, that is kind of the bridge between how you figure out what's going on in a system without knowing the system. So how do you help developers to write debuggable and understandable code? And I also contributed to Kubernetes and other tools like that. I like the feeling that cloud gives me, where I can write code that in some way is related to something that physically I can visualize. So it's not too abstract. For me, it was a good company and with a good culture, so I decided to take the baton.
It's interesting because when you think about the term cloud, you talk about something that you can see, but cloud by its graphical representation is just kind of the blob on the diagram where you don't know what everything is. When cloud computing became the thing that people were aware of 10 to 12 years ago, I would say that the way that I described it to people was it is sort of pay-as-you-go utility computing, but virtualization was an important part of it. Now we're starting to talk about environments that don't have virtualization, that are running bare metal. When is something cloud and when is something not cloud?
The way I define cloud is whatever is driven by an API. So that's mainly my definition. I don't really see virtualization as a key part of a cloud stack. And even before, when I was a heavy user of GCP or AWS, the fact that the AC2 by itself was a virtualized server for me didn't really change much because I had SSH access, I were able to use an API. So for me, the abstraction was enough to don't care about the underlying details. That's my answer to that, I presume.
If I'm a system administrator and I publish an API which says, get an instance, and then when you call that API, I leave that hanging for a month while I go down to the shop and buy a Dell box and come and plug it back in and everything. Am I a cloud?
I think you are a cloud. Back in the day when I used to work in Corlet, this is the company in Turin, they actually scaled with a cloud provider via fax. So they had to send the fax, and that was the cloud provider. So you definitely have to choose a good cloud provider, but that's enough for me to think about clouds.
While you were in the process of joining Packet, they were in the process of being acquired by Equinix. People who have heard of Equinix have generally heard of them in the context of running networks and being a location that people do peering at. Why do you think Equinix wanted to acquire Packet?
When you run the amount of data centers that Equinix has, that is like 200 and counting data centers around the globe, there is the opportunity to simplify or having a different way of selling that space. Equinix is a data center company. So in theory, you knock the door and say, okay, I want that room. I want power and data. And you pay for that. Mm-hmm. There is another customer that we may knock the door and say, I want that room. And I want that room full of servers with power and data connection. And that's probably, you know, the traditional way data center companies operate. When you have so many data centers, it's likely possible that you start to look at another way to sell compute or to sell your space. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that having that API layer in front of computing, it's a different way to sell and use compute power.
So a way that you can put an API layer in front of your computer is the Tinkerbell project, which you work on. Tinkerbell lets you provision and manage bare metal in a cloud-native Kubernetes-centric way. How did Tinkerbell come about?
Probably a similar story like the Kubernetes one for Google. So with the Equinix Metal or Packet back then developed an automation to do provisioning and much more around automation of data centers. And at some point, they realized it was a cool project and it serves today all the provisioning and all the hardware that you can ask on Equinix Metal. So Tinkerbell is that tool that we use internally with new concepts. You can think about the internal Tinkerbell that we have at Equinix Metal has a blob of bash scripts that are not really reusable, hard to package and ship and debug and troubleshoot. So at some point they thought, oh, maybe we can generalize this concept. And in the process of generalizing it, we can bring it to open source so we can validate with other community members what we are doing. And another opportunity when you open source a tool is that it makes collaboration easier. It's way easier to reach out to other companies or other entities and say, we are working at these open source tools and we want to make it better. So do you want to do it with us? This collaboration is important now that we have many architectures, many cloud providers, many vendors that are doing servers.
I've been working in cloud for quite some time now, so I'm not 100% sure what servers look like. Have they changed substantially in the last 20 years? Are they still pizza boxes that sit in a rack and connect to multiple power and network sources?
As I said, I'm born and raised in the cloud, so I'm not the right person to look back at how historically server was, but not that many servers that, and data center ISOs, because I joined Equinix Metal when the pandemic was already there. So I'd never had the opportunity to enter in a data center and look around. So I can't really tell. But I know that there are many specification for reusable hardware. So I'm not sure if it's a pizza box. I presume it is like a pizza box with a bunch of stuff inside that companies can glue together. So Facebook has the Open Compute program and Equinix Metal used and keeps developing the Open 19 standard with LinkedIn. That is a way you can build building blocks data centers. So you can pre-cable racks and design how you hook all those cables in a reusable way. It's a good world that I have for sure to go deep into. But yeah, I think the case is a pizza case for me. Not much different.
As an Italian, do you approve of putting pizza in boxes or should it be eaten fresh straight out of the oven?
I like fresh pizzas, but as long as there is no pineapple around it, I'm fine.
Because these are physical things that take up space in a room, we presumably have to put them in the room and then have services that we can call to turn them off or connect them. So what is the input to Tinkerbell? Do you give it a room full of computers that are already networked, or do you need to think about the setup before you start thinking about the software?
Tinkerbell is a stack, so it's designed to be replaced in its own bits. You don't have to think ahead too much about what do you want. For example, I have 10 nooks over here in my home network, and I can pilot them with Tinkerbell. Mm-hmm. So even if I don't have a fully operational data center with redundancy and who knows what, I can use Tinkerbell for my home lab.
But do those 10 servers need to be on and waiting all the time, or is there some automation that lets me turn them on when they're needed?
This is a good question that I'm actually trying to answer for myself. So when proper servers has BMCs inside that are boards, like you can think about that as a computer inside a bigger computer. And the small computer is the BMC. It controls the main one. The BMC is way smaller, so it consumes less more power, so it can stay up all day, all the time. And it can be used to switch on and off the main one and to monitor the proper server. So this is how, in a proper data center, you manage to have servers that are all power off and you power them on when needed. Because obviously, for cost saving and for safety, you can't leave them running forever. Mm-hmm. So you have BMCs and you can reach out the BMCs via various protocol and you can say, turn my server on, turn my server off, or pixie boot it, or start it from disk and so on. So this is how you pilot it. How does it work for a computer that is not a server, like a NUC? That's a good question. It depends on your NUC. I have here in front of me a board that you can't see, but it's there. It's a NUC that I disassembled. I started to learn the spec for that NUC, and I find that there are pins that you can use to control the board. And control means that you can check the status of the board, if it's on and off, and you can switch it on and off. So that's it. Mm-hmm. So I hook that to a Raspberry Pi, that is my BMC-like software. So I can leave the NUC off all the time and I can reach out to the Raspberry Pi to turn it on and off. So this is kind of what you can do if you want to play with a home lab that doesn't require you to buy an expensive server.
So we now have our baseboard management controller, our BMC, which is able to accept commands from the network. And effectively, it's a computer inside your computer, if you want, to be able to turn it on and off and control it. You mentioned there pixie booting. I'm never 100% sure what that stands for. Pre-boot execution environment? Well done. That dredged that one up from the bottom of my memory.
Even a laptop works in this way. So even the NUC has the same features. So they go over a bunch of boot devices. It will maybe your hard drive. It will maybe your USB stick. And if it can find none of them, it usually does pixie boot mode.
Not the floppy disk.
After the floppy disk.
After the floppy disk.
Usually pixie boot is the last one you have to try. So let me tell you the story of a brand new server. So Amazon rings your door. It comes with a box and there is a server inside. So you unpack it and you hook it to the network and you hook it to the power. When it boots, there is nothing inside the disks. You maybe not have any disks. So what does it do? It tries to boot from the hard drive. It doesn't find one. It goes to the USB. It doesn't find a USB. It goes to the floppy disk. There is no driver for the floppy disk. So it goes down to the pixie boot. And when the pixie boot starts, pixie does a DHCP request to the network. The DHCP is one of the pieces of the stack that Tinkerbell provides. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about them later, I suppose. But in theory, DHCP replies and says, okay, I know you via MAC address, so you have to run these little scripts. And usually the scripts contains the way you set up an IP for the server. It can be directly the DHCP, or it can be a static one if you assign one to the MAC address, whatever. So the server has an IP now. In that script, it receives how to boot itself. We serve an operating system that runs in memory, so a very small one based on Alpine. And from there, there is a kernel, there is an init RAM disk, so your server can boot an operating system. And you're almost done there, you have an operating system. Obviously, Tinkerbell gives you more capabilities. Like when we start the in-memory operating system, the OS itself starts a worker, an agent inside, that asks to Tinkerbell if there is anything to do. And usually the work that Tink Worker has to do is to provision an operating system. So from there, it executes a bunch of actions that are Docker containers that download a rootfs, download a kernel for your Ubuntu server, and it flashes everything on the hard drive. So from there, you can reboot, and now the server does the booting process again, but this time it can find an operating system on the hard drive, so it starts Ubuntu or whatever you installed. So this is the life cycle of a server, at least for the creation phase. There is a deprovisioning that works almost in the same way. So you issue to the PCB a request to reboot your server and you force the pixie boot environment. Mm-hmm. So from there is the same dance. The server restarts, but it jumps over the hard drive one and goes directly to pixie boot. So pixie start the operating system in memory, the operating system in memory starts Tink Worker that asks Tink Server what to do, and that's it.
Now, you've mentioned before that Tinkerbell is a stack of microservices, and there's a few of them that you will have gone through in order to provision and deprovision the service here. Tell me a little bit about the microservices that make up Tinkerbell.
There are a couple of them. They are all open source, and you can find them in the repository, but there are three that are the control plane of all the stack. So there is Tink Server that provides a gRPC API, and the Tink Server stores hardware information and it stores workflows, so what you want to run, and you can issue commands like start a workflows, or that is a deprovisioning or approvisioning workflows. There is a think worker that is the agent that runs on the in-memory operating system environment and interacts with the think server asking for work to do. And the think worker relies on containers and Docker has a runtime to take a list of app actions and run them on the hardware that you want to provision. There is a think CLI that is a command line interface that you can use to interact with the think server. There is boot. It is a DHCP server. So you run it on your network. It's waiting for requests from hardware that has to be provisioned. And what it does, it also serves Pixie scripts that boots the operating system, the in-memory operating system. So not the one you want, but the one that gets used to provision the one you desire.
Right.
And we serve, at this stage, two different in-memory operating systems. One is called OSI, and the other one is called Hook. OSI is the one that today Equinix Metal runs. Hook is a new one that we developed using LinuxKit. The last one is Heagle. That is a metadata server. You can think about that as the equivalent of all the cloud provider has a metadata server. So when you are inside the server, you can reach out to a particular web server, getting information from the server that you are in. So Heagle does the same. So when you are inside the hardware that you want to provision, you can reach out and get information about the IP of the server or the user data that you want to run and so on. So those are the piece of the stack.
The control plane services, they all run on top of Kubernetes?
They are not designed to run strictly on Kubernetes, but they are binaries, so you can run them everywhere.
You mentioned before that the actions that run on the machines run in containers. Is there anything specific to the Kubernetes control loop interface? For example, the asking what's going on, like is that using Kubernetes CRDs or anything behind the scenes?
The architecture is very similar. So you can think about the Think server as the API server and the Think worker has the kubelet somehow. And Docker is a runtime binary. The topology is the same for the services like Kubernetes, but there is no similar concept like a CRD yet. We made some experimentation about creating an operator to bridge the Kubernetes API with the Thinkable API, and I think at some point it will come in a solid state. We also have a cluster API implementation for Thinkable. So there is obviously a lot that we can do with the Kubernetes community, but by its own Thinkable, it's its own beast, let's say.
I'm not sure that you mentioned the best named microservice of the lot, which is PB&J.
I didn't mention PB&J too much because it's not yet hooked into the services that we ship as part of Tinkerbell, mainly because it controls BMCs. Not many in our community has BMCs in their lab yet, because we are learning that and there are two different spectrum of the community around bare metal. There are people that, like me, that has a bunch of Nooks or Raspberry Pis and they want to play with them. And there are gigantic companies like Equinix Metal that want to use that software for data centers. So there is a bit of back and forth there, but it can run for both use cases. And obviously the fact that it comes from the operational experience that Equinix Metal and Packet developed, it's a good sign that it's a solid tool.
I was going to say that there's not really a connection or a theme between all of the names here, but then you mentioned you've got a new one called Hook, so I can at least start seeing a Peter Pan theme emerging in the names.
You definitely spot the good one, so yeah, I don't know how it will end, but the naming is going well.
Now, you've been talking about Nooks, or Intel's next unit of computing, which are x86 devices. You've also sort of mentioned Raspberry Pis, but maybe you were mentioning that in terms of being the BMC for one of those Nooks. If I've got a room full of Raspberry Pis, can I use Tinkerbell to control them the same way if they were x86 PCs?
I have to say that we don't have a full story around Raspberry Pis yet, but all the binaries are compiled for Raspberry Pis, so you can use them. Mm-hmm. Pixie supports ARM, so you can technically run that. The two operating system we provide, Hook and OSI. Hook doesn't have yet multi-arch support. Mm-hmm. We are hooking it up because we use LinuxKit and LinuxKit supports multiple architectures.
Hooking it up, I see what you did there.
So it will come. OSI can run on ARM, but it's too big to run on a Raspberry Pi. We are almost there, and we are after the Raspberry Pi's setup as well, so it's just a matter of time.
Said a couple of times, you're born and bred in the cloud. A lot of us work in cloud and Kubernetes. While it takes from Borg, which was a runs on physical machines environment, it is very much thought of as a cloud thing. Do you see Tinkerbell as something that you would use to provision a cloud environment?
We open source Tinkerbell, as I said, because Equinix Metal used that concept to provision data centers and manage the automation of data centers. And Equinix Metal and Packet are a cloud company. So we expect that private and public cloud providers, that now the difference is very tiny, will be able to use Tinkerbell as a way to provision bare metal and in a fast and reliable way and to support a proper cloud provider expectation, let's say.
Very unfortunately, OVH had a major fire in one of their data centers last week. If you were recovering from something like that using Tinkerbell, do you think that would get you up and running again quicker than what the rest of the industry is doing today?
I don't think Tinkerbell by its own can do much when it comes to fire protection. You have to plan and care about how do you distribute your workload and how do you take backups and so on. So I think the OVH experience has raised a lot of questions to me. Obviously, they started to raise as soon as I knew that all the people were safe and the fire was under control or whatever. But I think it's a good experience and it should raise a lot of questions for the people that are using cloud providers and for cloud providers themselves. But I think a lot of them are already doing a good job trying to figure out all the possible scenarios. But sometimes you don't have them all under control.
Everyone who's running a cloud service today has some provisioning service. Would you like to see Tinkerbell become something that's more widely adopted, or do you think this is just a thing that suits your particular need and you're putting out there for people to run perhaps more in their home labs?
No, we definitely don't want to make Tinkerbell 100% tied to home lab. Mm-hmm. We're not working with that in mind. But we know that a lot of people, or even a lot of companies not that big, has something that looks like a home lab, has a data center. So it's definitely a community that we want to support. But we are going after much bigger use cases, more realistic data center. So it's definitely something that I hope that will get adoption for high scale environment. And we already have a couple of community members that comes from hardware vendors or hypervisor companies that are looking at how they can use Tinkerbell, because it's a hard job to provide a reliable API to do bare metal provisioning, because the feeling you get from the metal is different from the one you get from an hypervisor.
It's a lot colder to the touch.
Yeah, that's one. And it's also way unpredictably slow sometimes. So you send a message and you never know if it got there to the destination or what it's doing.
The guy's off ordering a server from Dell and he'll be back in a week's time.
That's not the cloud experience we want to provide with Tinkerbell, just to be clear.
Tinkerbell joined the CNCF last year. It was announced at KubeCon North America in November. What's happened to the project since then?
As you can imagine, when you take a piece of code that ran for like 5, 6, 7 years at scale inside a company privately, it looks differently compared with the one you expect to see from an open source project. So there is a lot of work ongoing around making it more generalistic and easier to figure out for people that are new to the project. And this is a simplification in concept and usability that Equinix Metal is looking for themselves. And having more people helping us figuring out all the bits and having different expectations is a very good way to improve the user experience for us. So definitely, that's an ongoing effort. We also saw many other companies and people looking at how they do bare metal provisioning. So that's very important. We started to work more closely with the Kubernetes community as well. So we started to do bi-weekly contributor calls. So if you want to join us, feel free to jump in, where we can speak about the evolution of the project and how people are using it or looking at it and so on. We also started to use Artifact Hub, that is a project developed by the CNCF, to ship all our reusable actions. So I mentioned to you before that Tinkerbell use actions that are Docker containers. And the reason about why we did that was to make them reusable and easier to move and ship. Mm-hmm. So Equinix Metal is writing more actions that are translation from Bash scripts to Docker container. In order to ship those containers, we are using Artifact Hub to do that. Ideally, we want to extend Artifact Hub to support workflows as well. And it means that moving forward, we expect to be able to reuse Proxmox installation on vSphere installation workflows or OpenStack workflows, OpenShift workflows mainly, more than OpenStack, I suppose. Ideally, is where we want to build a community that can help each other doing better bare metal provisioning.
When you're open sourcing something that powers your company, as Tinkerbell does at Equinix Metal, there is often, like you say, a bunch of bash scripts and things you might say, hey, I want to do this better for the public version. And I guess there's a couple of different approaches I see. One is to just open source it as it is and then evolve in the public and keep tracking that. Another one, for example, was what the Backstage team who we spoke to recently did, which is release a new version, possibly written in a different programming language, and then do all of the upstream work with the idea of eventually moving the internal stack to that. And they may or may not do that because they've already got a completely working version themselves. How did you decide which of those paths to take?
I have to admit that I wasn't there when the decision was taken, but if I have to look back and trying to reconnect all the dots, the fact that we have different services helped us a lot because we were able to say the DHCP server is good and can be open source as it is because it's well scoped and so on. So we open source that. Same for Eagle. And I think the part that we've wrote from zero is mainly related to the Tink server. So the API and the CLI and the concept of workflows that wasn't there, but got developed with the idea that bash scripts doesn't scale well as Docker images and a proper programming language, let's say.
You can always just run your bash script inside a Docker image. That'll make it scale.
Yeah, and that's what helps Equinix Metal to move forward without having to rewrite all their, or without having to throw away their operational experience. Worst case, you just package your bash script inside the Docker container and you hope for the best.
Now that Tinkerbell is open source and you're participating in a broader community, what sort of things are you looking for the community to contribute? Or how can people who are playing around with Tinkerbell help the project?
We have many different channels, like the Slack channel, or we have a mailing list for contributors. But what I think we need help with is the user experience. Mm-hmm. Because as I mentioned before, the one we have and the one that got developed in Equinix Metal was very tied to the Equinix Metal mindset, or that they had at that particular point in time. But now we have the opportunity to take all that operational experience at scale and make it more user-friendly. So that's definitely a good way to help. And even more, just play with it and let us know what you can do. Because as you can imagine, we just explored a fraction of the possibilities that bare metal provisioning has.
You want people to file off the rough edges of the metal?
Yeah, that's it. Just break the metal if you can.
Finally, when you're not tinkering with your home lab, I hear you can be found in your garden.
Yeah, I developed that desire to have a good garden because my grandparents do that all years since I was born. So for me, it was a great way to keep going and help them. But also because I work from home, I moved to Dublin for a couple of years and I got back when I started to work at Influx Data. And now it's like maybe 5 years that I'm working from home. So I was really looking for a way to get out from my bed and, you know, do something that was not typing on a keyboard. So having a garden, it's a very good way to do something different and use your hands more.
Well, it feels like everyone's been working at home for 5 years. Do you have any specialties, anything that you're really good at growing?
My family keeps tomato seeds every year from the previous year. Mm-hmm. We have like 40-year things.
A real heirloom tomato.
Yeah. Now I feel the pressure of not losing the seeds every year, so it's a bit pressing, but I think that's the specialty I have to develop at least.
Does it make a really nice pizza sauce?
Yeah, every year.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Gianluca.
Thank you for having me.
You can find Gianluca on Twitter at GIANARB or on the web at gianarb.it. You can find Tinkerbell at tinkerbell.org. Thank you, Vic, for helping out with the show today.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Craig. It was great to hear and see you again. I hope all is well on your end.
If you enjoyed the show, please help us spread the word and tell a friend. If you have any feedback for us, you can find us on Twitter at KubernetesPod or reach us by email at KubernetesPodcast@google.com.
You can also check out the website at KubernetesPodcast.com, where you will find transcripts and show notes, as well as links to subscribe.
I'll be back with another guest host next week. So until then, thanks for listening.